This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Among his first 100 days actions, President Joe Biden issued an executive order establishing a $15 minimum wage for federal contractor employees. A detailed analysis, though, shows the order won't affect federal spending much, but it will cause a lot of work for contracting officers. We get the details from the managing editor of Sensio Consulting, Kurt Cody. Mr. Cody, good to have you in.
Great to see you. Thank you.
And I should say you're joining me in studio, and this is the first for us in about 15, 18 months since the pandemic, so the world is returning to normal. But you looked at the population of contracts that could be affected by this executive order, and I thought the most amazing detail was the effect it would have on contracting officers. Tell us what you found out.
Yeah, when the executive order came out on, I think it was April 27th, you know, we saw a lot of great analysis on the macroeconomic impacts of the order, analysis on what it may mean for the standard of living for individuals who may be impacted, who are currently making the federally mandated minimum wage. But we didn't really see any coverage of how the government would put it into action. And when we started thinking about what our clients were going to be facing, you know, we realized there's going to be a lot of work that contracting officers and acquisition organizations are going to have to do in the next year.
Basically to verify that the contractors are doing what they're supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine that you're a government contractor and you put in your price proposal for a typical base plus four-year option contract. When you put your price proposal together, you're going in with a set of assumptions on what your cost is. Now imagine you're a contractor, you're in the second year of a contract and employ a, you know, a lot of folks that make the minimum wage, and all of a sudden your costs go up 50%, going from about $11 to $15. Well, it's reasonable for you to go to the government and say, hey, my cost basis has risen. Can I get an economic adjustment for the price that I charge to the government?
And so the bottom line is a lot of hours of work.
A lot of hours. So if you're the contracting officer, you get a request for an adjustment from one of your contractors, from one of your vendors. First, you need to take that data. You need to analyze what they're saying. You need to do your due diligence to make sure that the cost increase is substantiated with data. Then you need to make sure that there's budget available from your program office customers. You know, as we keep thinking about all the work that's going to happen, you know, we estimate based on our benchmarks, that's about 15 hours of work per contract. And, you know, the question is then how many contracts are going to be impacted? And we came up with about 30,000 contracts are going to need to be looked at, analyzed, and edited.
All right. And so what does that add up to in hours before people pull out their calculators?
Yeah. So 15 hours per contract, 30,000 contracts, that's 450,000 hours of additional contract workload. So that translates to about 240 individuals.
Wow. So that's a real piece of work then.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's spread across the agencies. You know, Department of Defense, obviously, as the biggest spender in the government, is going to bear the brunt of this. But agencies such as Veteran Affairs, USDA, the Department of State, they all have sizable contract portfolios, which we think are going to be impacted.
And you mentioned a total government-wide of some 30,000 contracts that could be affected. What is the general nature of those types of contracts?
Yeah, so our first analysis was, are professional services contracts going to be impacted? And, you know, as we suspected, the answer is no. You know, very few professional services contracts have employees making the federal minimum wage. Then what we did was we looked at labor classification data. And what we found out was, you know, there are a pretty discrete set of contracts that are going to be impacted. Janitorial services is the biggest. Landscaping services, food services, and laundry services round up the top five.
Yeah, so that's where people doing the contracting work and on which the bids were made then are low-paid people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We're speaking with Kurt Cody. He's managing director of Sensio Consulting. And again, DOD has the most contracts that would be affected by this rule.
They do. DOD, we're estimating, has about 11,000 contracts that are going to be impacted. VA is about 8,000. And then USDA and the Department of State are both about 2,000 each.
Got it. So agencies where there's people in uniform may have a lot to pay because the laundry goes out. Would TSA be part of that, I wonder?
I bet it would. I bet it would. TSA, part of Department of Homeland Security.
And let's talk about the impact on federal spending this will have.
Yeah, so that was one of our other questions. You know, after we looked at what's the workload impact, what's the implication on budget? You know, as we started, you know, thought 30,000 contracts, that has to have a pretty big impact, right? But these contracts, you know, they tend to be relatively low dollar figures. And what we've calculated is only about a $1 billion to $2 billion impact on total government spending. which, you know, $1 billion to $2 billion, it's not like that's nothing. But when you think about the government's total contract spending, $600 billion in 2019, we're talking about a fraction of a percent.
Yeah. So then what is the bottom line advice that you've got for agencies now facing a lot of work, possibly, a lot of examination? And probably it's fair to say every agency should look at the contracts, even if they don't have the quantities that DOD does. What are you telling people?
Yeah, we think every agency needs to look at your contract portfolio and identify how much spend you have in these key impacted areas. Number two, then go into those contract files and look at the pricing structure. That'll help you understand just how many contracts you're talking about. What's the workload going to be starting in January 2022? And then we're also recommending that agencies put policies and processes in place, right? We need to answer questions like, who's going to be doing this work? Will it be the responsibility of individual contracting officers, or might it be more efficient for an agency to set up a working group, a tiger team that will just handle this en masse? What data does the agency need vendors to submit to substantiate their request for price information? And how's that data going to be validated?
Right. And when does all this take place? There's a deadline. It's not tomorrow.
It's not tomorrow. So the order goes into effect January of 2022. Essentially, any new contracts that are awarded after that date, or when a contract hits its option period, that's the point that the minimum wage goes into effect, as well as guidance that agencies should start incorporating this now, even though it's not policy yet. It will be.
And there's also an open question here that's not strictly part of the research, but something we can imagine. I'm looking at, say, nursing services and trying to overlay that with, say, Veterans Affairs Department. Now, the Veterans Affairs Department has its own nurses as employees, but as they pay a larger number of community care advisors, I guess you wonder, will the administration extend this to people that are funded by the government, but not on a contract basis, but on some other programmatic basis, like the community care program?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a natural way to read the intent of the order, right? It was very clear in the order that this doesn't just apply to prime contractors, to subcontractors as well. So it seems like the intent is to widen this net to encompass all folks that do business with the federal government.
Yeah, so that could be by the contracting medium or by any one of other mediums, grants, for example.
You've got it.
And just briefly, what was your methodology for discovering and distilling out all of these different types of contracts and the quantities associated with them?
Yeah, so there was a lot of data analysis that we did. It started with looking at government spending from FPDS. We then looked at labor classification data from the Department of Labor, as well as prevailing wage data, also from the Department of Labor. And then we looked at cost structure data from benchmarks. You know, how are contracts structured? Where are the costs coming from that build up to agency prices?
Sure. And a final question. There is a little bit of regional flavor to this because the contractors in the South pay less than those, say, mowing lawns in Albany, New York.
Yeah, exactly. Just like any facet of the government, the prevailing wages are much higher on the coasts than they are in the Midwest and Deep South. So as we're advising our agencies, we're recommending, you know, don't just look at the categories of contracts, but look at the place of performance. If you have a janitorial service being executed in New York City, you are certainly paying those employees more than $15 an hour. If you're in the Midwest, in the Deep South, yeah, you may have a sizable population that would need to be plussed up.
All right. Good report to see all of this quantified. Kurt Cody is a managing director of Sensio Consulting. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
We'll post this interview along with a link to his analysis at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Rick Wade, Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Rick was a Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. He worked closely with the Obama administration, and he also worked with Commerce's Economic Development Administration to foster regional economic development in distressed areas, and with the Minority Business Development Agency to create jobs through the growth of minority-owned businesses. He received a BS from the University of South Carolina and an MPA from Harvard University. Rick, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Rick, in today's environment, leaders have had to adapt and find new ways to lead with transparency and empathy. But can you tell us a bit about how you've adapted your leadership style?
You know, this past year has clearly presented some unique challenges that certainly me, or I as a leader, have had to adapt. You think about a pandemic, for example, that has placed us in probably one of the most challenging circumstances is to sort of lead in a virtual world now. I've not been in my office for nearly a year. And the idea that we don't have the human interaction, which I think is very important when you think about the empathy that is a very important value of leadership. So trying to lead from a virtual environment, Shane, and be empathetic and be sensitive to the needs of others has presented a terribly difficult challenge. One of the other defining moments, I think, in our time that has dictated a change in leadership, if you will, was the murder of George Floyd. I think it created a whole different consciousness in America and certainly within me about the importance of being empathetic in the way I lead, to be inclusive, to lead in a way in which you're very sensitive to the impact of your decisions on others across our community. So it certainly has been a challenging year to adapt, but I'm happy to say that I'm still here and we're moving forward.
Perfect. Throughout your career, what have been some pivotal moments or lessons learned that have shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, there have been so many moments, Shane. I grew up in rural South Carolina. Quite honestly, at a time when I saw what legal segregation was. I mean, I wasn't able to go to an integrated school until middle school, being bused across town. And I remember, as strangely as it may sound, in 1979, I wanted to run for vice president of my student body at Lancaster High School, a rural school. And I had to run on the ballot as vice president Black, literally. And there was another candidate who ran as vice president White. And the irony of that story is that the following year, I ran for president and I won overwhelmingly. That was a lesson for me in leadership. And the lesson there was, you know, perseverance, have the tenacity, have a vision, and overcoming barriers. And I didn't let the idea that the construct that I had to run as vice president deter me from reaching my bigger dream, which was to represent students. So I know that's that perhaps may be a small example of leadership, but it really did define how I view myself, the vision that I have, my willingness to fight for change. And that was the beginning. I think that set the foundation of how I lead. And there've been so many other moments. One of the most defining moments for me personally was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A very close friend of mine, Senator Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who lost his life. And it conjured up, again, these issues of how deep the divide in terms of race in America is. But it also inspired me to lead even more and to lead harder and to lead with diligence and vigilance to help close that divide. So there have been so many defining moments in my career. I will tell you, even after the murder of George Floyd and my role at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to galvanize the business community inspired by that tragedy. And now we have a whole broad, historic, sweeping, what we call Equality of Opportunity Initiative that I'm leading, that I was inspired to develop. And we're bringing together corporations from across America to address what we call equality of opportunity. So my point there, I think, with all of these moments, they've all been pivotal moments at different parts of my life, my career, my journey. And I've seized those moments to make the best of them, of what I could.
That's fantastic. It's a great, great answer. Many stories. Thank you very much for sharing that. Who is the most impactful leader in your life? And what quality did you admire about them?
You know, I can't say that I had just one, but I would tell you the one person whose historical leadership has inspired me the most, and that is the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's so many attributes there that are consistent with my values, but the one part of his leadership was vision. And I mean, the idea that you can have a dream, which we often define and think of his big I Have a Dream speech. But I think that's a really important attribute of leadership, Shane, that you can sort of see beyond the challenges of today and see a better future for people and for yourself. So the idea that leaders have vision despite the challenges is seeing a forest despite the trees. It's in an opportunity despite the barriers. And that attribute, I think, is one that I embody. I mean, I'm very optimistic despite the challenges, despite the circumstances. So the whole notion of vision was a very important attribute that I learned and that I've tried to emulate from the leadership of Dr. King.
Wow, fantastic. And as someone who's got an extensive background in federal service, and out of federal service, what advice would you give to feds looking to develop leadership skills? And you can talk about mid-career, senior career, early career. What comes to mind there?
Yeah, listen, I mean, you're aware that I had the fortunate opportunity. We didn't have a Secretary of Commerce when President Obama, of course, I served as one of his senior advisors, was inaugurated. And the president asked me to go to the Department of Commerce to hold the fort down. And that was one of the most exciting experiences in my entire career, not just for the title and the wonderful experiences, but I understood the value of federal employees. And folks forget sometimes, Shane, that we political appointees, we come and go. But the folks who are grinding every day, who are at their desk no matter rain, sleet, or snow, who bring innovations, but yet don't get the credit for it because the political appointees get all the credit. I think I learned something about the humility of being a leader. And I built so many friends who were federal employees, not just at the manager level, but the frontline workers, the administrative assistants. And I was very deliberate. I mean, one of the things that I was most proud of, strangely enough, I was that guy, even though I was senior advisor to the Secretary of Commerce, and my office was on the floor, the top floor. We call it the blue carpet, Jane. But I made a deliberate point to go eat in the cafeteria every day, as many days as I could, just to sit down and talk with employees. And I grew from that. And there were so many times where I took their ideas back to the blue carpet and said, and I told the Secretary Locke, you got to go down and sit down and talk with regular, common, everyday folks. They're in the cafeteria, not in the dining room on the blue carpet. And so he started doing that. So the point is, I think for me, the advice that I would give is to continue to do the hard work. I do think that we should do a better job in government in providing the kind of admiration for those workers as we do the high level appointees. And that may be something that I'm looking to work on myself to help continue to advocate for our federal employees. Those are the hard workers. That's where the work gets done. And so I think that's a lesson for me. If there was some advice and counsel I could give, is to continue to do your work. But we have to do our work as leaders of these agencies to create ladders of success and reward and admiration for the hard work that they do.
Rick, thank you very much. You've inspired me. These are tremendous insights and stories. I love every single one of them. You've got a fascinating journey in leadership yourself. And thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Thank you for listening to today's Lessons in Leadership podcast. And until we see you next time, take good care.